Every morning, even before I open my eyes, I know I'm in my bedroom and my bed. But if I go to sleep after lunch in the room where I work, sometimes I wake up with a feeling of childish amazement. Why am I myself? What astonishes me, just as it astonishes a child when she becomes aware of her own identity, is the fact of finding myself here and at this moment, deep in this life and not in any other. What stroke of chance has brought this about? If I look at it from outside, my birth in the first place seems unlikely. The penetration of that particular ovum by that particular spermatozoon, with its implications of the meeting of my parents, and before that of their birth, and the birth of all their forebears, had not one chance in hundreds of millions of coming out. And it was chance. A chance quite unpredictable in the present state of science that caused me to be born a woman. From that point on, it seems to me that a thousand different futures might have stemmed from every single movement of my past. I might have fallen ill and broken off my studies. I might not have met Sartre. Anything at all might have happened. Tossed into the world, I have been subjected to its laws and its contingencies, ruled by wills other than my own, by circumstances and by history. It is therefore reasonable for me to feel that I am myself contingent. What staggers me is that at the same time I am not contingent. If I had not been born, no question would have arisen. I have to take the fact that I do exist as my starting point. To be sure, the future of the woman I have been may turn me into someone other than myself. But in that case, it would have been this other woman who'd be asking herself who she was. For the person who says, "Here am I," there is no other coexisting possibility. If this necessary coincidence of the subject and her history is not enough to do away with my perplexity, my life, it is both intimately known and remote. It defines me, and yet I stand outside it. Just what, precisely, is this curious object?
I'm seated in the very gracious apartment of Madame Simone de Beauvoir, 11 Bisou, Chelchef. Is that right,
Madame Beauvoir?
Yes, exactly. In Paris, I see we're surrounded by books, typewriter writings. Madame de Beauvoir certainly is one of the most influential figures in French literature today. And as I sit here, seated opposite Madame de Beauvoir, I think of another lady who was a great feminist of her day, Margaret Fuller of Boston a century ago. And Margaret Fuller, too, traveled to various parts of the world and saw what she wanted to see, what she intended to see, the truth. I think we have a prototype in the 20th century in Madame de Beauvoir. The readers in America acquainted with several of your books, of course. We were first acquainted with you as a feminist when The Second Sex came out. And it occurs to me, you're working on your memoirs now.
Yes.
Madame de Beauvoir.
Yes, I am writing the following volume of this memoir. The first one has been called The Memoir of a Dutiful Daughter, I guess, in the States. In France, it was Memoir d'une jeune fille rangée. And the next one will have another title. I don't still know which one. And it will take me into the end of the war, until Paris liberation. And there will be after a third one, which will take me until nowadays. But that's a far away plan. What I am doing now is the second volume. It's nearly over. I'm going to give it to my publisher, Gallimard, in a few days.
I think that since Memoirs of a Dutiful Daughter, Volume 1, Your Childhood, has been published in America, perhaps a bit of this, Madame de Beauvoir, I think that listeners to the station would like very much to know how you got this way.
I'm alone. One is always alone. I shall always be alone. I find this leitmotif running right through my diary. But I had never really believed it. I sometimes used to tell myself proudly, "I am not as others are." But I seemed to see in my difference the proof of a natural superiority which would one day be acknowledged by everybody. I was no rebel. I wanted to be someone, to do something, to go on progressing ever onwards and upwards, as I had been doing since I was a little child. Therefore, I had to get out of the everyday rut I was in. But I believed it would be possible to rise above bourgeois mediocrity without stepping out of my own class. Its devotion to universal values was, I thought, sincere. I thought I was authorized to liquidate traditions, customs, prejudices, and all kinds of political and theological particularism in the light of reason, beauty, goodness, and progress. If I established myself in life by writing a work which would do honor to humanity, I would be congratulated for having trampled conformity in the dust. Like Mademoiselle Zanta, I too would be accepted and admired. I made the brutal discovery that I'd been wrong from the start. Far from admiring me, people did not accept me at all. Instead of weaving laurel crowns for me, people were banishing me from society. I was filled with anguish because I realized that what people were reproaching me for, even more than for my present attitude, was the future that lay ahead of me. I would always be ostracized. I couldn't imagine the existence of environments other than my own kind. Here and there a few individuals stood out from the common mass of people, but I never had a chance to meet any of them. Even if I were to form one or two friendships, they would never console me for the sense of exile I was already beginning to feel. I'd always been made much of, and looked up to as the center of excited comment. I loved being loved. The bleakness of my future terrified me.
Your childhood was that of a middle-class Parisian family, wasn't it?
Oh, yes, quite middle class. They had some money before the First War, and then they lost every money, so we were rather poor, to say the truth. And my mother was a very pious woman, and my father did not believe in God, so it made quite a discrepancy inside the family. So my father always respected very much my mother's belief and the way she educated my sister and myself, but I could feel a difference between them. And that was the beginning of a lot of thinking about the world and the people and sin and God and all that. I guess it was the most important family circumstance, this difference between father and mother. But anyhow, I was raised in a very, very Catholic pious institution, a how do you say, college named Désir. And I stayed there until I passed my first exams when I was 17 and 18. And so the whole thing was a very traditional Catholic bourgeois education, indeed. But with a lot of circumstances which made me have to think and to want to know things about the world. And chiefly my father liked very much reading, and he was very pleased when he saw I liked it too. And so he gave me great encouragement in that. And, well, I began to like reading very, very, when I was quite a little girl. And at the same time, I began to want to write. But then it became much more serious when I was 15. And, well, it became quite serious when I was a student. And I decided, really, I should be a writer. It was the first thing I had really decided in my life.
It's always, ever since you can remember, you wanted to write. Was that it? You yourself?
Well, it was just a play at the beginning, a game. A lot of little girls or boys went to write when they are 8, and it does not mean so much. But it came to be much more real when I was 15. And, a kind of little papers a girl keeps for herself and asks a question.
Diary.
Well, not exactly a diary. Keepsake, maybe you call that. Well, a friend of mine asked a stupid question. What do you want to be when you'll be a great person, adult? What do you like best in music and all that? And I answered all the questions, and all was very silly because I did not like red more than violet, and I had to say I liked that or that. But when her answer was quite true, when she asked, what do you want to be? And I said, I want to be a well-known writer when I am a woman. And that was true. I was 15, and it was the thing I wanted the most in the world.
And you say a great deal of the encouragement came from your father. Your father
was... Yes, when I was young. He liked very much the idea he was to be a bright woman. After, it was more difficult because he did not like so much the idea I would be a working woman. It was quite different. He liked me to have culture and read, and so if I was a lady of the world, to have knowledge and all that. But when he has no money enough to marry my sister and myself, who is giving money, dowry, we call that. And in France, it was very useful at this time. So my father said, you'll have to work. And I was very pleased at that, but himself he was not pleased and did not like very much when I was a student. And chiefly my ideas became different from him, his, because he kept being conservative and I was beginning to be quite left-wing on a lot of questions, colonialism and all that. And very quickly I came to be this way, and so we had real antagonism at that time.
It was my father who made me realize what it would be like. I'd counted on his support, his sympathy, his approval. I was deeply disappointed when he withheld them from me. It was a far cry from my own high-flown ideals to his morose skepticism. His moral code insisted that institutions should be respected. As for individuals, they had no other purpose on earth than to keep out of trouble and enjoy life to the best of their abilities. My father often stated that one should have an ideal, and though he detested them, he admired the Italians because they had one in Mussolini. Yet he never suggested what my ideal should be. But I didn't expect him to do as much as that for me.
But anyhow, it was too late to prevent me from doing anything, too late to make me feel really unhappy about that. So in the world I had a very easy childhood and youth, even if I had some rather black years in youth.
In general, your childhood was a conventional childhood, was it not?
Very conventional. Oh, quite conventional. With my mother was quite provincial. She came from province, and everything was quite conventional about me. And chiefly, my father liked me to read books, but there were chosen books, real books for little girls. I had no right to any book, a little, not even daring, but a little free. I had to know nothing of the facts of life, and nobody told me. I had to find everything myself, as all little girls who are not told do, in fact. And he kept a very, very close eye to everything I was reading. It's even incredible how stern, how difficult it was, because very innocent books even were so too romantic, or I could not read freely until 18. And then that was one of the reasons my father did not like that, because when I went to the Sorbonne, I could read everything, and I did indeed. And before I read hiding from parents, not before because I wanted to read dirty books, but because I wanted to read books, that's all. And the one who were allowed, that was so little. So I read Musset as well as Hugo, as well as Zola, as well as Maupassant. Everything from 14 to 18, my parents not knowing it. My mother just knew it when she read my memoir, and she was very sad. She said, I did not think you could have lied to me. I said, yes, I had to, because you would not have let me do if I had said the truth. She said, that's true, I should not have let you do that. So I had to hide.
You say your mother read your memoirs?
Oh, yes. She was rather sad at some things. She was pleased at other ones, but at some things she was rather sad, chiefly when she knew I had lied to her. After 40 years, it kept quite a wound for her. Oh, she could not accept it. I had been a liar when I was 10. Even now I am 50.
At the same time, Madame de Beauvoir, I'm curious. You said your mother was pleased to... Your mother came from a very, you explained earlier, even more conventional than your father.
Oh, yes, much
background.
More.
Yet, is she secretly proud of you, the fact that
oh,
you
yes.
are...
Oh, yes. She's proud. Yes, she's very proud because... Well, because I make a little money and I'm a little known, every mother is proud at that. And then she does not look too close what is inside the books. She has a mother, says it, a blindness for it. She tries anyhow.
But when you went to Sorbonne, then this is where you read what may have been called the forbidden books. Is that it? Books that your father did not choose for you.
Oh, yes, this I could read what I want.
Yes.
Then they knew.
Yes.
They knew I had to. And then I became a kind of strange monster for them, quite a freak. But we kept along nicely, but it was not the life they would have chosen.
It is amazing, though, how your life and that of this woman who lived more than 100 years ago, Margaret Fuller, her father, too, encouraged her to read, and later on she
yes.
broke away from him.
Oh, yes.
I think listeners perhaps would like to know, what were the influences in your life, perhaps, that made you, that led to your being the artist you are? You broke away. You say there were things that you noticed, you know.
Yes.
Are there specific influences among writers, perhaps?
No. The deep processes was not by external influence. It was the conflict inside my home and among friends too, and in myself. And everything was nearly decided when I was 20. Well, I was influenced by books which all the young people of the time liked. But I took the influence because I wanted it. It's not the books which made me what I became. I went to this book because I was becoming what I became. I mean, for instance, Gide had a big influence when I was 20 because he spoke of being free and being oneself. Maybe it was the greatest influence at the time. And then I read a lot and I take a little of everybody, but I cannot say anybody has really made me become different from what I should have been anyhow, I guess.
There's something you just said you inferred it came from was not an external influence. It was an internal.
No, yes. Yes, internal.
Need that you felt to find yourself.
Yes, it was an internal story. And then it was not found when I was 20 because, well, I passed my exams and I began to win my life. I was a teacher. I said goodbye to father and mother and I went to my own place with their agreement. And I went to Marseille and Rouen in different towns of France, which was quite a break-in with all my old life because I had to be a teacher in these places. You don't go first in Paris when you're a teacher. First you have to go in provincial towns. And I was very happy to go to Marseille, which is a very, very beautiful town. And there I lived by myself all alone for a year. Then I came back to Rouen. From Rouen I came to Paris. I could see the old friends again, but anyhow I was on myself too. So that was quite a new life, earning my own life and then beginning to think very seriously to write in books. But in fact, I did not write my first book before 10 years. For 10 years I tried and it was always so bad, so bad, so bad. I knew it was bad and I did not even try a publisher. And then when I was 28, I tried a publisher for a serial of short stories about young girls of my time and all that. And it was not so bad as the other things, but it was not good enough. And the Gallimard said very, very shrewdly, it was not good enough. I should begin with something better. And then I began another book, and I put much more of myself in that. And that was She Came to Stay, which was called in France L'Invité. And that was my first published book.
I lacked the courage to plunge straight into the heart of my chosen subject and make a frank study of the 30-year-old woman I then was. I came to it obliquely, partly at least through sheer technical incompetence. I was determined that my heroine, to borrow a phrase from D.H. Lawrence that had much impressed me, should have roots. I also admired the way in which Faulkner contrived to play tag with the time scheme of Light in August, but his technique was designed for a novel constructed on a fatalistic basis, whereas I was concerned with free and unpredictable decisions. Besides, I was aware that breaking up the flow of a narrative with episodes in flashback tended to make it rather heavy going. I therefore decided to take the character based on myself, I gave her my mother's name, Françoise, and tell the story of her childhood and youth in their natural sequence. I did not put my own real recollections into her mouth, and my description of her, at one remove, was couched in a style that I had once again borrowed from John Dos Passos. I took up a theme that I had already explored through the medium of Chantal in Primauté du Spirituel. I tried to suggest the sort of deceptive trickery that young girls so readily adopt in their efforts to acquire status. I provided Françoise with a friend whom I called Elizabeth, and who had not the slightest connection with Zaza. I gave her instead the physical attributes of one of my 15-year-old pupils, whose mass of ash-blonde hair and black clinging dresses made her look a complete vamp. Elizabeth was embarking upon life with a provocative self-confidence that her school friend Françoise found quite overwhelming. Once again, I was concerned to present the mirage-like aspects of an alien personality. In actuality, Elizabeth was a mere slavish reflection of her brother Pierre, whom at first Françoise had scarcely even met. I drew at length, and in detail, a picture of Françoise's uncertain relationship with a young lecturer on art history, who somewhat resembled Herbeau. Finally, she became acquainted with Pierre Labrousse, and they formed a close relationship. Elizabeth, who felt a violent but unreciprocated love for her brother, became jealous of Françoise, and then herself succumbed to her charms. I spent the whole year working on this first part of the book.
It was published in Fort Edry. But I began to write it in 39. But it was late, considering it was such a long time I had wanted to be a writer. But I had to struggle very much against a lot of things, and the chief led not really wanting to tell things which I cared for, because it's not so easy to begin to really speak about what you care for, and as long as you don't do it, it's no good. And then, since I began... Then I did not stop. I knew I could always speak about things I care for, and so the books were good or bad, better or worse, I don't know exactly. But anyhow, there were books which could be published and which people read and some liked.
Things you cared for, you see, you said, Rabbi,
yes.
Things you cared for, and of course, I suppose, being an individual, being a woman, and of course we come to your book that first brought your name to America was The Second Sex.
Well, but it's not the first I wrote.
No, I mean in America, the one that perhaps was made you best known there, the beginning.
Well, but when I say it was not the first I wrote, because if you are interested about me, it will interest you to know that being a woman was not at all a problem for me. It was never a problem, and I discovered it was a problem for other women rather late, when I was maybe nearly 40, because as I had an intellectual, very steady life, I could do what I wanted. I did exactly I passed the exams I want. I wrote the book I want. I had very good friends, man and the woman, and the men were never superior with me, because left-wing intellectual men, they are not too many of them of the superior kind. And so I did not resent at all being a woman, and I never resented it. So my first books were not at all about being a woman, but about being a human being in connection with others, being a human being. And then there was the war, the occupation, and there was the problem of being a human being in a society you are against, and against oppression and the Nazism and all that, a lot of story. And then death, how you can manage to accept to be a living being knowing you are going to die. That was all men are mortal. All these problems I care for much more than the problem of being a woman. And I came to the problem of being a woman later, when I decided I should write about myself. And then I discovered that the first thing I should say, if I was speaking about myself, it would be, I am a woman.
On this truth must be based all further discussion. A man never begins by presenting himself as an individual of a certain sex. It goes without saying that he's a man.
And I began to consider if it had been different for me, being a woman or not being a woman. And I discovered it had been. And then I let the idea of speaking about me, and I decided first to see what it meant in our society nowadays to be a woman. And that was how the second sex came. But it did not come directly from a personal problem, because it was not a personal problem for me. I say that because in France, lot of men, which are still feeling superior, because there are a lot of them, said I had written the book because as a woman I felt inferior, and I had pretended to fight against this inferiority. But that was not a bit true.
It was objectively. It was an objective.
Quite objective. Quite. And even it was a discovery for me that women, after all, had handicap and had not the same possibilities that men, and that the condition of woman was different, was a peculiar condition. I did not feel it by myself. So I learned it by writing the book.
Thus, humanity is male, and man defines woman not in herself, but as relative to him. She is not regarded as an autonomous being. Michelet writes, woman, the relative being. And Benda is most positive in his Rapport du Réel. The body of man makes sense in itself quite apart from that of woman, whereas the latter seems to be wanting in significance by itself. Man can think of himself without woman. She cannot think of herself without man. And she is simply what man decrees. Thus she is called the sex, by which is meant that she appears essentially to the male as a sexual being. For him she is sex, absolute sex no less. She is defined and differentiated with reference to man, and not he with reference to her. She is the incidental, the inessential as opposed to the essential. He is the subject. He is the absolute. She is the other.
This matter of being a human being, you've mentioned this several times, which leads to perhaps the new word in the vocabulary of the world. You've been associate, your colleague, Jean-Paul Sartre.
Yes.
We had no external limitations, no overriding authority, no imposed pattern of existence. We created our own links with the world, and freedom was the very essence of our existence. In our everyday lives, we gave it scope by means of an activity which assumed considerable importance for us, private fantasies. Most young couples tend to enrich their normally somewhat bare past with intimate fantasies and myths. We embraced this pursuit all the more zealously since we were both active people by nature, and for the moment, living a life of idleness. The comedies, parodies, or fables which we made up had a very specific object. They stopped us from taking ourselves too seriously. Seriousness as such we rejected no less vigorously than Nietzsche did. And for much the same reason, our jokes lightened the world about us by projecting it into the realm of imagination, thus enabling us to keep it at arm's length.
The father of what we call existentialism. This is a word of a philosophy so often misused, the phrase, and so often abused. Can you, in your own way, Madame de Beauvoir, offer what you feel is the idea, the basic tenet of this
of the idea of human being or of existentialism?
Existentialism.
It's very difficult to speak of that quickly, you know, because the misunderstanding came from the fact that existentialism is, after all, a real philosophy. And a very difficult one. And Sartre just has written a 800 big pages book to explain now what is his situation about existentialism. So, and then this first book about it had 700 books, pages, and there were a lot of others. It's very difficult to sum up 2,000 pages into words. But what I can say, and what was important for me, it was the accent put on the importance, I guess, existentialism was first against the, that was like that in Kierkegaard, and we took that from Kierkegaard, against the philosophy of the history and the universe by Hegel. It was an effort and a c'est tentative, an essay, to maintain the rights and the existence and the reality of the human individual with its freedom and with its own possibility. It was in a time where there was a very big pressure of history and the world, since chiefly we got to it during the war. It was a protesting against this crushing of the man by the universe, and an effort to make a conjuncture And the whole philosophical work of Sartre was to try to tie together these two things, which are very real, that there is a terrible weight of the world and the materialistic condition of life on man, and history and everything, and in a way an individual is nothing in this big course of history and of the universe, but at the same time, freedom means something, and there is something left in man, in existence, that cannot be just explained by scientific way and historical ways, and that was the whole work, and that was it needed a whole system of philosophy to make the two things get really together, not in a superficial way, but in a deep way.
Isn't this what you have been seeking all your life, really? I mean, the individual banking on himself. Isn't that the idea?
The idea was to find the individual in relationship with the world. Because when I was young, I misunderstood the importance of the external world. I believed you can just do what you want and think what you think by yourself. And little by little, I learned that my own ideas was the reflection of things going around me, that my own life was the reflection of a lot of things going on in the world, that I was not at all a lonely person, and I did not invent and create my own self, myself, but it was in a most part of it was just given, and it was depending about circumstance very much, and that was the war, which was a big revelation about all that. And when going deeper and deeper in the experience given by the war, I discovered the tightness of the ties which tie me to the whole world. And then I tried to keep on the pride of being an individual, but it was not at all in the same way as before the war, because it was not by ignoring the rest of the world. It was by keeping something, even knowing with eyes open and not shut. That was the big difference.
That a man must be, a human being must be involved. Is the word engagé?
Involved, committed, I guess you say.
Committed.
Too. He must commit himself to something. He must, because he is, anyhow. That was the one thing we discovered, too. He cannot help being. And if he pretends he's not, he is always being used by some part of the world or some other. There is no possible neutrality. That was within. If you pretend to be neutral, then some people use yourself, maybe you not wanting it. So we think you have to commit yourself because you have to choose with whom you are and against whom, and not to be just picked by people pretending you are picked by nobody. You are always picked one way or another way. You always help this one or this other. The poor against the wealthy, or the wealthy against the poor, you have no choice. And if you pretend just to stay and do nothing, even staying and doing nothing means something, and it goes to one of the camp or the other.
Staying, you just hit a point here that intrigues me very much. I'm thinking, you said staying and doing nothing. This, too, is a matter of choice,
yes.
You say.
Yes, and but it's a choice that is a very tricky choice. Because in a way you pretend you do nothing, for instance, and then you're doing nothing, help some people to do something you don't want, if you see what I mean.
Indeed I do.
You just shut your mouth, for instance, and you let people say the contrary of what, in fact, you rather think. So you go against yourself, and there is only one thing, is to begin to speak yourself your own way. You have to say it's black or it is white, or I am against it, or I am for it, because if you say nothing, your silence is used by the one you are for or against, but in spite of yourself. So it makes a discrepancy inside yourself because you are used by people the way you don't want. So you have to coincide with what you really choose. That's why you have to make an explicit choice, a human choice, and not just be chosen by others with a complicity which you don't really accept.
I'm thinking as we're seated now. I don't know the language at all, but I feel among the intellectuals and those of them, there's a bit of sadness now in France. This can you account
yes.
for this?
Oh yes, because we feel we are guilty. Because anyhow, all left-wing intellectuals feel they are guilty for the sin other people do, but we don't prevent them to do. We feel guilty because we have not the power to do what we want, or to prevent others to do what we don't want, and we feel sad because of all that. And then chiefly because we have felt the occupation and we have hated the Nazis when they tortured and oppressed us, and we were in the resistance. We don't understand the people who have been in the resistance now do exactly the same thing to the Algerians that the German made for us. That's very difficult to understand. That's not understandable, and anyhow, we don't accept it.
What do you see as what outlook is there? Do you among the young writers today, the young French novelists, the playwrights, the great many, is there a way out? A way out?
Oh, well, there are a lot of them. We just choose not to bother with public affairs, and we take just a very individualistic way of writing and fiction or play. They just tell a little unimportant story, and then they give a very great importance to the form. As you said, you say form too, the shape of and not the inside of it. And that's much of what is called the new fiction, the new roman, nouveau roman in France. It's much an effort to make something new with a very old feeling and a very old word, not trying at all to change the word or to change the feeling, but just trying to say that in a slightly different way. For me, it's not very interesting, even if they are talented, because literature should be more than that. They are too humble in my idea. I mean, they just keep on to the same old traditional story, pretending not to be traditional, only in the way of telling the story. But always old bourgeois story, very, for me, very little interesting.
Comes back again to the committed man, doesn't it? The creative spirit must be a committed man.
For me, yes. Now they think not. But I think they are wrong, and that's why their books, even if talented, don't go higher than a certain degree and they don't know very high. Yes, all the great writers have been aware of another committed people who wanted to help the world to change by telling how it is, because to tell how a thing is, it's to do more than just give names. It's helping to make people take conscience of it. Even naming a thing is to make people take conscience. When you have named something, and the word can give much light on what is happening. So we writers, we have to use words, but to give light, to make a light, a true light on the word, and help people to see it in its truth. And that's being committed, anyhow.
Well, do you find among some of the younger French writers committed men in this sense, among some of the younger ones today? Do you?
No, there are not many good writers who are committed. There are some committed young men, young writers who are not very good, that's not to say, because then they don't take care enough of something or another, then there must be art too in literature. We must have both. And it was not true what some critics said, that the committed school, as they called us, did not care for art. We know very well without art you can say nothing. What we say is the writer has to say something and not just to put words with art for saying nothing. But if he says something in a bad way, in a wrong way, artless, well, nobody will listen to him, so he does not do what he wanted. He missed the aim the same way.
Of course, he must be a talented, he must be a creative spirit as well as a committed
yes.
man, naturally.
Yes, and a lot of young good-willing writers have no heart and don't take care enough of having heart, so they don't hit. And a lot of those who are talented and who are interested in art, they don't want to be interested in what happens and so don't commit themselves. And that's why we are not real great books since sometimes.
Well, certainly Simone de Beauvoir is a committed creative spirit. And now you're working, you're continuing with your memoirs, volume 2. Volume 2 finished?
Yes, no? It's finished. It's going to be sent to the publisher. Well, it's committed in a way, it's not committed in another, this book, because it tells of past stories, since it stops, as I told you, in 44. But in another way, it's committed, I guess, because it shows the struggle of individuals, Sartre and myself, I speak very much of Sartre too, to see the truth and to find their real relationship to the world. And it shows how much you can be blind and mistaken and how wrong it is when you don't take care of this tie with the world. So I guess in a way, though I don't intend it first to be that, but it can be quite a lesson for people, learning the same lesson I learned myself. I mean, just because I went through that, it was a lesson, and other people can maybe profit by it the way I hope I have profited a little too.
Well, Madame de Beauvoir, I know we're nearing the end, and you have a lot of work to do with your memoirs. You are an artist who calls her shots, in American slang, for someone who sees the truth and writes of it. And I'm honored indeed to have had this time of speaking with you and having you air your views. Anything else you'd care to say? One last thing about yourself, literature, the world?
Oh, you know, there are so many things
to say.
I don't care for saying any peculiar things just now. I'm very glad to have been able to explain a little myself to the American public you get on your radio.
Sartre once told me he did not feel he'd written the books that at the age of 12 he hoped he would write. But after all, he added, why should a child of 12 be privileged? My case is different from his. It is, of course, very difficult to compare a vague and limitless plan with a realized finite body of work, but I do not feel a gap between the intention that incited me to write books and the books that I've written. I've not brought the shimmer of feelings back to life, nor caught the outer world in words, but that was not my aim. I wanted to make myself exist for others by conveying as directly as I could the taste of my own life. I have more or less succeeded. I have some thoroughgoing enemies, but I've also made many friends among my readers. I asked no more.
And I guess that's all for today.